there and welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies. I'm your host Ian Cook and today we're talking about Delhi, Pages from a Forgotten History by Arthur Dudney. The book is published by Hay House India and came out in 2015. And Arthur Dudney is a Leverhulme Early Career Fellow at the Faculty of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Cambridge. The book tells the story of India's capital and beyond through the lens of Persian literary culture. It's a real lively read written for a mass readership and details the lives of poets and emperors along with the origins, rise and decline of Persian in the subcontinent. I had the pleasure of speaking with Arthur just a few moments before.
Okay, so it gives me great pleasure to welcome Arthur to the show. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. I found your book a really enjoyable read that retells the history of Delhi and beyond from a new perspective. So I was wondering, for a first question to dive right into the book, why did you decide to tell Delhi's story through that of Persian literary culture?
Right. Well, thanks for having me. So the thing to know about Persian in India is that as a living culture, it's just about to fade out of memory. So the Urdu poets who were getting their start, say in the 1950s, were required as a matter of tradition to be able to produce a few poems in Persian, just to prove that they were good poets in Urdu, and they're all quite old now, and so once that generation is gone, then this culture will really just be something that we have in books. Persian was really important for Indian elite culture for many centuries. And it's something that really in my own reading, I haven't found synthesized in the way that I've tried to do in this book. There's a way in which modern Indian languages are full of Persian words, are just deeply reflective of this Persian literary culture, and yet for political reasons, just because of and also just because of simple forgetting, people aren't really aware just how deep this went. And there's a pervasive idea which was really got its start in the colonial period, that Persian was somehow not authentically Indian. That anything that was written in Persian was somehow marked as foreign, and not really part of the authentic Indian experience, whatever that would mean. But actually, this idea is wrong. If you look at it historically, it's much more complex. And Indians at different points in history thought of themselves as masters of Persian, and to be able to show this from the beginning up until the present day, when very little of this survives, I think is a very good way of thinking about Indian cultural history in general.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. And what brought you to this topic personally?
Well, I had an unusual education in that I started as a student of classics, as a student of Latin and Greek, and European languages. But I didn't really fit well into the classics curriculum as it was, because my interest was not, you know, how someone would have read a text when Virgil or Cicero had written it, but rather why that text was relevant at different points in history. Paper has a very short life, so any text that we have from the ancient world was copied. It had to be picked up and written out, and that's something that's always very much interested me. Why were certain texts valued so much that at different points in history they were copied out and circulated? Why did other texts die? And why do why did people at different points in history look back at these particular moments in the history of ancient Rome or the history of ancient Athens and think this is a culture which is worth bringing forward? And that is not really a question that's asked in a department of classics. It's more something that's in the field of comparative literature. So I was always between these two fields, and it was when I visited Delhi myself, just on the invitation of a of a friend of mine and her family who had nothing better to do than to host me for a summer, I realized that these questions about textual authority and how you move from a classical tradition into a vernacular tradition, that it's something that was a bit more immediate in the Indian context, and that furthermore in the context of Western academia, if you study the non-West in a Western university, you're much freer to pose the questions however you'd like to pose them, because you're not going to be the 500th person to write a PhD thesis on Virgil's Aeneid. So I felt as though I could really sort of break new ground by studying India. And originally I thought that I was going to do a project that was looking at the way in which the Sanskrit epics, particularly the Ramayana, how those were retold in Hindi and in other modern Indian languages, and sort of trace the history of that translatio studii from, which is just a pretentious way of saying moving knowledge from one tradition into another, how that translatio studii could be traced through particular texts. Eventually, I realized I wasn't very interested in Sanskrit, and it became much more a project about Urdu and Persian, and I became very interested in the way in which the Persianate literary tradition was converted into a sort of a new cultural system, which later became known as Urdu, and that turned out to be a fascinating question, tied with the way that the society understood language fundamentally, and I was able to address many questions about the way that language not only developed naturally but was actively constructed through what linguists now call language planning, the idea that that an elite group or a government can change the way in which a language is used. We very often have this romantic idea that language is completely natural. We have these biological metaphors to explain how language is developed, but in fact, people very often think about what aesthetic language is and what unaesthetic language is, what language spoken properly is versus improper language, and that's it sort of rubs up against our romantic notions that poetry sort of expresses how we feel at a particular moment, and it's somehow authentic, but of course, for a tradition like Persian or for Urdu, the rhetoric is very important. And by thinking about rhetoric in history, it's a way of essentially decentering this notion that there's a particular kind of authenticity, and that's very important. So that is a very long-winded way of explaining where I come from and why I now study this particular aspect of rhetoric in the Persian and the Urdu tradition.
No, it's a good introduction, not only to the topic, but also to your understanding of it as well. So it's great. So let's start from the very, very beginning, which is what you do yourself in chapter one. So where did Persian originate and how did it make its way into India?
Well, to answer this question, we have to go back a long way in time. We have to start with Proto-Indo-European, which, as many of your listeners will know, is it's a reconstructed language. In other words, because it existed and it ceased to exist before writing was used, it means that we actually have no sample of this language. So what linguists have done is they've moved back in time. From modern languages like English, German, Hindi, to the languages that came before them, and then even then again to what what we're interested in this context is a language group called called Indo-Aryan, which gave rise to the Iranian languages. So modern Persian is the one that we're most interested in, but also other languages like Kurdish, and then on the Indian side to languages like Sanskrit, but then also to the modern vernacular languages of northern India. And so Indo-European, as I said, there's no text in it. It's reconstructed from later languages. So it's a theory, but of course it's a very well attested theory in the same way that to use a biological metaphor, as I said, we probably shouldn't. It's like evolution in that it's a theory, but it's a very, very well attested theory. So there was a group of people. We think they lived around the Black Sea. We think they lived around 7,000 years ago. And they spoke a language, which for some reason, which we'll never quite know, and certainly they could not have known at the time, was the seed for all of these other different languages, the Indo-European languages, which spread across Europe, spread across South Asia, and then eventually later made it to the New World. And Persian and all of the northern Indian languages are linked through this shared history. So eventually the language spread. And at one time, the Indian languages and the Iranian languages were the same. They came from the same root language, and eventually they split off into the Iranian languages and into the northern Indian languages. So Persian and Indian languages have this very, very deep connection. Which was sort of lost in the sands of time, but which was later understood, both by European scholars in the 18th century, but also, as I'm sure we'll discuss later, by Indian scholars, in the 18th century, who started to get the sense that there must be this deep connection between these languages. Now, there are a lot of intermediate steps, but eventually a language develops, which we now call New Persian. And New Persian, whenever I say Persian in this conversation, this is what I'm talking about. So formally we call it New Persian, and this is the language that develops around the 9th century, and is still eventually becomes even the national language of Iran today. It has this millennium long history, but it's grammatically quite a conservative language, which means that it's still fairly easy to read texts that were written so long ago. Anyway, so this Persian is the language that was brought into India by traders and by Mahmud of Ghazni, who was an early conqueror in the 10th and 11th centuries, and he his empire that spread into India was very much a Persian language using empire. And again, that particular political formation faded. A few centuries later, the Delhi Sultanate came into being, a series of dynasties, which again, really respected Persian. And then it fell to the Mughals from the 16th century to really make Persian the sort of keystone of the administrative system. And then eventually that was by the 17th and the 18th century. That's when many, many Indians were learning Persian, in in a parallel to the way in which Indians learn English today. It was a language of social betterment, we could say. And so that's the sort of the sketch of how of where Persian comes from and how it came into India.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thanks for that. This sets us up nicely to now start to talk about some of the particularities. And I think a good way is to start by talking about a particular poet, which you do in chapter two, Ame Khusrau, if I pronounce it correctly. And at some point in the book, you say that Delhi was his city and he hated leaving it. So I was wondering, could you please tell us who he was, why he was called the Pirate of India, and how he and his work were bound up with the city?
So Amin Khusro was a poet who lived in the late 13th century and the early 14th century. He has a very familiar story. He came from a small village, basically, in the middle of nowhere, and was recognized as having so much talent that he made his way to Delhi. He made his way to the big city, where he became one of the great classical poets of Persian literature. He's one of the poets who was so prolific and had such a good reputation that that his work was known across the whole Persian-speaking world, from Anatolia, which is modern Turkey in the west, all the way across Central Asia to the Chinese, the Western Chinese frontier. And around India, he was arguably the greatest poet that India ever produced. At this time, Delhi was a thriving, massive city. It had something like 400,000 inhabitants, which meant that it was the second largest city in the Islamic world at the time. Only Cairo was bigger, And it was a place where Amir Khusro really thrived, because he had noble and royal patrons, but he was also connected to the Chishti Sufi order, and particularly to his spiritual guide, Hazrat Nizamuddin. And in fact, Hazrat Nizamuddin and Amir Khusro are buried near each other in the same complex in what's now called Nizamuddin Basti in sort of south central Delhi. So Amir Khusro had this spiritual connection to this important Sufi order, but at the same time he was a very successful poet, and was always just like the Sufis themselves were always trying to balance their spiritual aloofness from the world with the possibilities of political patronage. Amir Khusro was performing the same balancing act, and was recognized as a very successful poet and making a great deal of money from his poetry. But at the same time, he was not particularly happy with the life of a courtier. He wasn't particularly happy that he would have to, at the whim of a patron, produce bucket loads of poetry. And he especially disliked when a patron asked him to go out on campaign, because in a context like this, the emperors and the noblemen, they took their households with them whenever they went on campaign or whenever they went anywhere. And so even the poets had to come along as well. And these were the times, we know because Amir Khusro said so in some letters that are preserved, that he was the least happy. He would rather have been at home in Delhi, sort of thinking about the higher aspects of poetry rather than being stuck entertaining these patrons of his in the sticks. And so Amir Khusro, when he was able to produce his great work, these works became known around the whole of the Persian using world, and Khusro, as the parrot of India, he got that moniker because he really was a symbol of India. He was he wrote in certain works that essentially he wrote as any court poet. He wrote praise poetry about India, and he implied that he was proud of being Indian, and so had this reputation as the parrot of India. On the other hand, I think that nationalists, later nationalists, especially in the 20th century, have done him a disservice in trying to read this pride as a kind of pride in the Indian nation state, which of course wouldn't exist for centuries. And it's always a mistake to try to read references to India or to Indianness from this period as mapping easily onto modern understandings of citizenship. But clearly he was very proud of his situation, and very aware of himself as an Indian, but also as someone with a Central Asian background. And this is something that we'll see time and time again. There, before the modern nation states, the empires in Central Asia were very fluid, and in fact the Mughals who would come into power a few centuries after Amir Khusro, they were Central Asians, and they had no, at the beginning they had no sense that they would stay in India. So there's this constant cultural and military movement through the Khyber Pass. And this is something that we see time and time again. And it's very problematic for people who want to claim that the Indian culture is something unchanging and indigenous when in fact you can see that there's this constant movement back and forth from the northwest into India, bringing new ideas and bringing commerce. These commercial links were always very important.
And talk of the Mughals segues us nicely onto my next question, because you start chapter 3 with a quote from Babur, who's of course the first Mughal emperor, and his quote is very unflattering about India. I'll read it. He says, "The cities and provinces of Hindustan are all unpleasant. All cities, all locales are alike. The gardens have no walls, and most places are flat as boards." Yet, despite this, subsequent Mughal emperors really fell in love with Indian cities and created conditions for a flourishing Persian literary culture. So I was wondering, could you please talk us through this change of heart?
Yes. So Babur was, I think we might call him a warlord. He had a very large family and essentially a band of warriors that he called upon. He came from the Fergana Valley, which is a beautiful, lush place on caravan routes, which is in the upper eastern corner of today's Uzbekistan. And because of political machinations, he was thrown out of his home by this very large family had different small empires around, and so essentially his home was taken from him, and he then moved around Central Asia with the people who were loyal to him, conquering as he went, and eventually. Eventually setting up shop in Kabul. The problem was that he was eventually, there was no more territory to conquer and he was hemmed in. And so really the only place for him to go was India. And so he made a few forays into India, but eventually by the 1520s, as I said, there was nowhere else to go. And so he, he and his soldiers swept into India, defeated the last of the Delhi Sultans, and were in charge of the place. They were in charge of the fertile part of northern India, and it was a sort of, I mean, for us in retrospect, I mean, one thing that I try to do throughout the book is to think about historical contingency and to try to think about, there are certain things that we know now that seem to make things inevitable. But if we were the Mughal war band who had just swept in from Kabul into India, it was by no means obvious that this would be the beginning of an empire that would bring stability to India, and that would be completely swept out of Central Asia. Babur still thought of himself as a Central Asian, and so he brought with him this culture, which was they were generally Chagatai Turkish speaking in their daily lives. That was their vernacular language. But they had Persian poets, and they freely quoted Persian poetry, and that was as it was in India at the time. Persian was the language of high culture and of administration, if not of daily life. And so Babur had his retinue of poets, including an important poet called Ali Sher Navoi, who was now claimed as the sort of national poet of Uzbekistan, because he was primarily a Turkish poet, but he, like other poets, was bilingual and also composed in Persian. Although we know that Babur didn't particularly respect his Persian poetry, because he tells us as much. The thing that we really have to keep in mind about the Mughals is that they were inveterate diarists. We know so much about Babur and what he thought because he left us a text called the Baburnama, which was written in Chagatai Turkish but with many Persian quotations in it. Which is very good evidence of how important Persian literature was, and this text was was read by the first two generations of Mughals in India, but then eventually their Turkish wasn't good enough to read it anymore, and it was eventually translated into Persian by a courtier, Abdur Rahim Khani Khanan, a few centuries later. Other Mughal emperors also kept these journals, and really carefully recorded what they were thinking and what they saw. So the Baburnama has long sections describing the flora and fauna of India, and also things like how commerce worked, at the same time as giving us a very good sense of how Babur's inner circle really functioned. And really what it was a lot of warriors getting very, very drunk together and reciting Persian poetry. And it's an interesting transitional moment because of course the Mughals are descendants of the Mongols. They're very proud of that link to these Central Asian steppe nomads who were able to, because of their superior horsemanship, were able to sweep across Asia and into Europe, and eventually, as they became more sedentary and their culture came more into contact with the settled Iranian culture, with its respect for Persian, they picked up many of the arts, the architecture, the painting, the poetry, the elegant prose composition, and they integrated that into their own cultural system, and it became something new and fascinating to reconstruct, and that's what eventually was brought to India. So India famously has a capacity for integrating different cultural traditions, and it was able to integrate this cultural tradition, which was itself so integrative. I think I just coined a word, but that's okay. So really, for Babur, when he came to India, he came to India and was amazed by how different it was, how strange it was. The animals were different. The climate was different. He and his friends had never really seen a hot place. They were used to the temperate and even cold steppes, and they came to India and it was hot all the time. And in fact, some of his followers asked for permission to go back to Central Asia because they just couldn't manage the climate, basically. And so Babur looked at this place and as in the quote you read, he didn't really like the way it looked. The cities were not attractive to someone who was used to the monumental architecture of Central Asia, with its beautiful tile work and things like that. So there was an aesthetic problem, and so he tried to rectify this by building Central Asian gardens, the so-called charbag, or the quadruple garden, which is a square garden which has four squares within it, which are divided by walkways. And this is if you go to a place like Humayun's tomb in Delhi or the Taj Mahal in Agra, this charbag is still the pattern of gardens which are used by later emperors. Now, besides these aesthetic problems that Babur perceived, there was also a kind of moral and intellectual problem. For people like Babur, these drinking parties were very important because they showed a kind of comportment, which is called it's called suhbat in Persian. Suhbat is in modern Persian it means conversation, but at this time it was better translated, I think, as comportment. It was all the different ways in which people related to one another elegantly, according to the right manners, using the right language, using the right literary forms. Quoting poetry to one another as a way of not actively instead of actively giving someone a command. Someone might instead quote a verse of poetry to make it clear what was required, but without actually having to give the command. And this is especially important, not a superior commanding his junior, but rather a junior asking for something from his superior. It was very difficult to demand something of someone who's higher up in the hierarchy, and so there were oblique ways of doing it. And so suhbat was this central cultural construct, and Babur came to India and he said, well, no one has this, no one has this elegance. And in a way, what he set about doing was inculcating this kind of culture of performance and of conversation in the people he encountered, and that, of course, is what the Mughals eventually developed into such a wonderful and such a unique form of literary and intellectual and social culture.
Wonderful. Now let's Let's go there. Let's move and talk a little bit about this sort of culture developed under the Mughals and skip forward a little bit in history and talk about Shah Jahan, who's probably most famously known as a builder, both in South Asia and I suppose internationally. But of course, he was also a sponsor of the arts. So I was wondering, could you talk us through how, under his rule, what ways did Persian poetry and literature develop?
Yeah, so of course, Shah Jahan built what we now call Old Delhi, but which, of course, when he built it was Shah Jahanabad, Shah Jahan's city. And Shah Jahanabad really was a sort of physical manifestation of the Mughal views on aesthetics and ethics and morality. It structured in the world the way in which they thought. And so Shah Jahan was he became emperor at a time when the empire was sort of well established, and also at a time when there was political upheaval in Safavid Iran. And so he was very lucky in that it was the time when the sort of peak of immigration from Iran took place. And so not only did he have the resources of India at his disposal, but so many Iranians decamped from the major Iranian centers of culture to India that the Mughal court and other local courts in India were able to draw upon this vast pool of talent, and by essentially paying people better than they could have earned in Iran, many important poets came and sort of built this poetic and bureaucratic culture that was also very aware of how it was anchored in Indian life as well. And so Shah Jahan sort of presided over this moment of not only great physical construction, but cultural construction, and he in a way guided it, just as his predecessors Akbar and Jahangir had. They really sort of the Mughal Empire was at the height of its prestige, and really had by then developed a system for all of these different kinds of communication and literary support and supporting great ateliers where miniature painting and bookmaking were also reaching their peak. So it was sort of the best time for sponsorship, but also for just because circumstances in the world, in the Persian using world as a whole, meant that there was this tremendous flow from other parts of the Persian world into India. And while that was always the case, there was always this movement. As I said, the Khyber Pass was always this conduit for Central Asians to come to India and Indians to trade in Central Asia. This was the time when you could say a bit crassly, when the price was right, when the imperial apparatus really could afford to compensate the great Iranian poets so well that they all felt that it was that coming to India was a rung on the ladder of career development.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Now, 18th century India is usually depicted as a time of cultural decline, that there's a breakdown of central authority, that there's many invasions and a decline in the arts. But you argue quite forcefully in one of the later chapters, and also you bring it up in the introduction, that it's not quite as simple as it's usually painted.
Yeah, to understand the 18th century, we have to think about the sort of the great political event of the early 18th century, which was the death of Aurangzeb. Aurangzeb was an emperor who ruled for a very long time at the end of the 17th century and into the 18th century. And he, because he was very very austere in his religious observance, has usually been contrasted in historical writing with the Emperor Akbar. Now, Akbar is seen as the enlightened emperor who was open to Indian culture and the arts and sort of created a tolerant empire. And Aurangzeb is seen as being too austere, too bigoted to be able to preside over an empire as culturally complex as the Mughal Empire. And the idea is that he hastened its end just by being a bigot. Now we've moved well beyond this idea, I think, because Aurangzeb, although personally he was not that interested in the arts, and in a society like this where the emperor has a huge family and a large number of retainers who very much get their cultural the cultural trends are set by the emperor, it does mean that there was less. There was less interest in the arts at the center, and you can see a typical painting from Shah Jahan's reign, which is colorful and beautifully embellished with decorations, and then one from Aurangzeb's reign, which is just a usually muted greens and browns and gold with very little decoration, and that very clearly shows the way in which Aurangzeb was a different sort of cultural consumer. But at the same time, the idea that he was a bigot and presided over a massive destruction of Hindu temples and rejected Indian culture wholesale, all of this, that's all very overdetermined and to my mind, not true. What did change was this, as I said, mainly this, because there was the lack of interest on the part of the emperor in different arts that had once been very prized. Although Aurangzeb himself was very well educated in Persian and did write a bit of Persian poetry, and also wrote beautiful Persian prose, it meant that there was a decentralizing effect. And so culture that had once been funded at the Mughal court itself, vast ateliers of painters and the poets, these now moved outward to the courts of individual noblemen. And so it's difficult to say that there was at that moment a decline. There was definitely a decentralization, but in some ways things were very culture was maintained, but at different levels, not necessarily at the center. In writing Mughal history, there's often a problem of confusing decentralization and decline, saying that they're one and the same. But especially when you're talking about something like culture, it becomes problematic to make such a blanket statement. So anyway, to go back to the 18th century, once Aurangzeb died, there was quite a bit of political turmoil, and there's seemingly a contradiction in that the really complicated politics, which involved, for example, in one year there were a number of different emperors who just deposed one another in succession, and there were various invasions most notably by Nader Shah in the late 1730s. So Nader Shah here was a Turkish speaking warlord who was able to conquer all of Iran, and then eventually turned his sights to India and really humiliatingly defeated the Mughals and robbed the Mughal treasury. And that of course was a great blow to the society. But at the same time, the poets and the intellectuals were able to function despite this political turmoil, and indeed were very very interested in the in what Nader Shah's army and his administrators how they used their documents. Not as many people have assumed, because now here were these Indians who were encountering these Iranian quote-unquote native speakers of Persian. After all, remember that many of these people are actually Turkish speakers. But they encountered these people, and they were very interested in the whatever administrative changes would be made now that there was a new administrative dispensation with all of these people who had come with Nader Shah and had sort of inserted themselves into the Mughal establishment. So things were certainly in flux, but at the same time, culturally, things were very, very very, very rich in this period, because people were turning to the philosophy of language in ways that they never had before. And this is really the subject of my PhD. So my PhD is about someone called Sirajuddin Ali Khan, by his pen name Arzu. And Arzu was arguably the sort of greatest. In his work, he took the concepts about the fundamental nature of language further than anyone ever had in the Persian tradition. And what he did was he took writing in Arabic, centuries old philosophy of language in Arabic, and he reworked that into something that had contemporary relevance. And through this, he was able to think about the way in which Persian and Indian languages were connected, and really make an argument for the kind of literary culture that was developing at the time. Because now Urdu, what would later become called Urdu, was at the center of things, and so people living in Delhi, people who were poets, they were composing both in Persian and Urdu, without seeing those as necessarily in conflict, because for later scholars, for later nationalists, it's very important to say that Persian was artificial and people were giving up on it, and Urdu was natural and people were embracing it because it was the natural language of northern India. But in fact, Persian provided the framework for the early philosophy of Urdu literature, and therefore Urdu as a spoken language, and that's what Arzu was so important in developing, and also in adjudicating disputes between people who were arguing for new styles in poetry and people who were wedded to the style of the so-called ancient poets, meaning the classical tradition. And so Arzu essentially comes up with a formal system explaining how symbolism works in poetry, and how when a symbol is appropriate and when it goes too far. And so he theorizes innovation in a very important way. Not only that, but in thinking about innovation, he also thinks about the way in which in which words can be borrowed from Indic languages into Persian. And he also creates a system to adjudicate whether it's appropriate to borrow a word or not, which of course had been happening for centuries, but it was a matter of consternation for some people because poets would comment on each other's work. This is not a Persian word. You're not allowed to use this. So it was very important for Arzu to say, well, actually, it is okay to use Indic words under certain circumstances, using a particular kind of authority in the tradition. Authority is a key word, and it's key in my work because we have modern linguistics, we tend to think of authority as being synonymous with native speaker privilege in a language. And historically, and especially in a tradition like Persian, which is used from Turkey across Central Asia to China and in India, the people who are actually native speakers of this language are minimal because it's a taught language. It's a taught tradition. In many ways, akin to Latin in early modern Europe, very few people were native speakers of Latin, though there were a few mostly weird experiments in that way. But almost everyone learned this standard language, and that's the same way it was in Persian. There were many different dialects, but the actual formal written language was restricted, and this is one of the things that Arzu was actively thinking about, and thinking about both the historical and the contemporary ties between these different kinds of language use. And so he was it's all very interesting because Europeans would come up with ideas that were quite similar to this, only because the Persian tradition because Persian became a dead language in India, all of this great philosophy of language never went anywhere. It was abandoned, and it's one of these historical what if scenarios. What if it had been allowed to develop further? Would we have a different way of thinking about the way that language works in our own analysis today?
Yes, absolutely fascinating. I suppose one of the nails in the coffin for this, or the start of the sort of reduction of Persian in South Asia was British colonialism. Now, initially, they adopted Persian as a language of administration, but then they decided to stop using it. So I was wondering, can you explain this change, and also how did this also change literary culture?
Yeah, so of course, when British colonialism began in India, Persian was very much still the language of administration, and so they fit themselves right into that system and basically acted as though they were just another Indian state. So they received the newsletters from other courts in Persian. They wrote letters to people they were dealing with in Persian. And there was a very large Persian analysis and writing section in the administrative establishment in Calcutta. They were off to a very rocky start when they first came to India because they weren't very good at producing the kind of paper that the Mughals valued, or the kind of literary language. And so basically when the documents that they were sending to Indians were considered laughable because they were just so badly written, you know, as though today you made you were making a formal request to the government just on lined paper written in pencil. So that was that was something that took them many decades to learn. But eventually they learned the technology very well, the technology of writing and even of literary language as a technology, because the thing that really changed eventually with colonialism was that this literary Persian language, where every document would make literary references, every document began with a long formula and closed with a long formula. The British dispensed with that once they got more confidence, and that's what really changed. They became more confident, and they then started to change the Persian themselves, and they simplified it. They made it less literary, and eventually they eliminated it completely, because it was Persian by that point had become one more language that that a young cadet would have to learn in order to function in India. Now, of course, literary patronage became less and less available, because by the end of the 18th century, there was no question that the Mughal establishment was in complete disarray. By the early 19th century, once the British had conquered Delhi, the Mughal emperor was no more than a figurehead, and even he received he was kept in place as a convenient fiction, so that because of course British rule derived its legitimacy from the early revenue collection rights that the East India Company had received from the Mughal emperor. But by this point, the Mughal emperor was practically a prisoner in his court, and even things like the presents that he would distribute to his very large household, he made a show of still presenting those gifts. But in fact, the company had given him the money in advance, and had a very precise list of which present went to which person. So there was just no more the Mughals were broke by this point. There was very little literary patronage. There was very little funding for literary patronage, even though there were still, people forget that there were poets who were essentially still composing most or all of their work in Persian into the mid 19th century. Now at the same time, as Urdu developed, and Urdu was very, very heavily patronized by the colonial state, because it was seen as an alternative. And as I alluded to earlier, there was this idea that Urdu was the sort of natural language, and Persian was this sort of foreign, imposition, which doesn't really belong in India. And the British really promoted this idea, especially after they did away with Persian in government after 1837. But I mean, these are of course all moral judgments which are applied. Are part of a long process of in a way delegitimating Persian for whatever purpose. And even, I mean, this is outside the scope of our conversation, but the complexity of writing a proper Urdu literary history is still something that scholars struggle with, because there is this idea that obviously Persian deeply influenced Urdu. But there's a moral quandary that people find themselves in when they admit that, because they think that somehow makes Urdu fake. And so even in the 19th century, the great Urdu literary historians were struggling with the idea of how do you admit that Persian was an influence while somehow bracketing off Persian as being this immoral thing, whereas Urdu is somehow a natural, national, properly Indian language. And of course it gets tied up with the question of the difference between Hindi and Urdu as well, because it's a fact that colloquial Hindi is full of Persian words, Whereas the Department of Official Language in the government of India, which promotes a particular kind of Hindi, is trying to prune out all of those words and replace them with either more obscure indigenous words or in some cases Sanskrit neologisms, which have just been made up to serve the function of somehow indigenizing the language and taking Persian out of it. And in Pakistan, you see the opposite happening, where words that sound too Indic are pruned out of the language and are replaced with Arabic words or Persian words. And in many cases, it's funny because Arabs don't recognize these Arabic words that Pakistanis are now using in their Urdu because the government told them to.
Sorry, I didn't want to stop you.
No, that's sorry.
But it's great. I mean, and I think that's something actually that runs through the whole book, which I really liked. It's a nice, subtle and timely political intervention, I think, as well. And so I think I want to highlight that for the listeners as well, that this is the book really serves this purpose nicely as well. I also wanted to say actually for the listeners that this is a very readable book. I mean, it's you don't need a PhD in linguistics or classics or South Asian history or anything like this to read it. It's an enjoyable read for everybody, and this is how you've aimed it. So I wanted to highlight that as well.
I'm very grateful to you for saying that, because yeah, that it's a nightmare to market a book like this, because I tried so hard to make it readable and make it interesting, but at the same time, I think people pick it up and look at the transliteration of the Persian passages and think, "Oh my God, I can never read this."
But no, at least for me, it was really a pleasurable read. So let's hope it does sell well and it just gets out there. I was wondering if there's anything that I might have missed in my questions that you'd like to highlight.
Yeah, I think maybe I've alluded to this several times, but I think just thinking about being citizens in a modern world which is full of nation states, that's now the fundamental unit of how we build societies. It's very important, I think, to think about rhetoric in the past. Why did people say things the way they said it? Not a superficial reading where we assume that people. That people are just sort of speaking how they feel, or speaking, an easily traceable truth. But how does the way in which people speak, and the different forms of speaking and language use that are available to them, how does that shape what they're able to say? And how, in fact, is that very different from the way in which we have this romantic notion of people sort of, which has a particular genealogy of people sort of speaking, saying what they feel, or composing poetry in this romantic way where you express your emotions. And it's less about having a system of symbolism, which was very much the case for a tradition like Persian and Urdu, right? If everyone writes about the moth circling the flame, or the lover, the mad lover, chasing his beloved in the desert. That doesn't mean that this is not that's somehow inauthentic or not an authentic way of expressing thoughts and feelings. And it's very easy for us today, I think, to dismiss a lot of this. And that's why I think, the reason I wrote the book really was to try to recover some of this, and especially when there are these debates about what it means to be Indian or Pakistani or Bangladeshi today, how there is this well of historical material that in a way people haven't really drawn upon, because it's rhetorically difficult for us to wrap our minds around, because it's not the familiar it's not a familiar way of communicating, but it's not any less valid than the way in which we communicate today. This incredible linguistic richness which we've probably lost in the West, but which to some degree is, well, to a great degree is still the case in India or Pakistan, where there are so many different languages available and so many different traditions.
Wonderful. Thanks. So now that this book is out, what are your current and future projects?
Well, I'm working on a few different things. I'm finishing up the revision of my PhD thesis into a published book, and that's it'll be a great relief when that comes out, because that's sort of some of the material that's in this book developed as I was thinking through the archival material and the various questions that were being raised. And it would be nice now that I have a sort of accessible book out in the world. Now I can follow that with an academic readership, different ideas that I think are important for our understanding of where India fits into this great Persian cultural formation. So that's one thing I'm working on, just filling in the gaps in that. I'm also I have a 3-year project at Cambridge, which is titled "Making Persianate People," which is really thinking fundamentally about education in Persian, because as I said earlier, the way in which I'm talking about it in this historical period, it's not a national language. It's a transnational language, a cosmopolitan language, which has to be taught and learned. And even for people to even if someone never wants to leave the court in Delhi, even if someone never wants to travel to Iran, in order to work in that court, one still has to be educated in this transnational language. And that's very important, the way in which the universal affects the local and the local affects the universal. And surprisingly, there's never been any work that looks at the way in which the Persian language and the literature that accompanies it is taught outside of Iran, outside of the places where Persian is, where a dialect of Persian is spoken natively. So I'm looking primarily at India, but also at Central Asia to think about over the centuries how was Persian taught, and it comes as no surprise that India was very important for this, because many many important teaching tools were actually written in India, especially in the 18th century. And so it's very, and again, it's a way of looking past this idea that Persian is somehow artificial in India, because it's clearly so well integrated in the society that it's taught in this, everywhere from village schools to the imperial court itself. And lastly, I have a sort of fun project, which I might be jinxing by mentioning it here, but I'm working on a novel which is based in the Dastan tradition in Persian and Urdu, this sort of magical storytelling tradition, which is great. It just provides so much material. So that's in my very limited spare time, that's what I'm working on.
Wow, they all sound fascinating, and we look forward to reading the fruits of these sometime in the future. There's nothing much more for me to do today apart from to thank you again for coming on the podcast, and thanks for the opportunity to speak about your wonderful book.
Yes, thanks very much for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks so much for downloading the New Books in South Asian Studies podcast. I've been your host, Ian Cook, and today we've been talking about Delhi, Pages from a Forgotten History by Arthur Dudney. Thanks again for downloading, and I hope you listen again next time. Ta-ra!